welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. In an NPR report from September 5th, President Trump signed an executive order on Friday to give the Department of Defense a new name, the Department of War. The change returns the department to a name that it carried for much of its history, until it became the Department of Defense in the aftermath of the Second World War. During a press conference in the Oval Office, Trump tried to explain that the name change was designed to reflect a new tone for the nation and the military. A White House fact sheet explains that under the executive order, the name Department of War will serve as a secondary title for the Department of Defense, although Trump backtracked a bit, stating that he did not believe he needed congressional approval for the move, but he also promised that Congress would get behind the rebranding. According to the fact sheet, the order will also authorize Defense Department officials to substitute the word war into their titles. For example, the Secretary of Defense could use the title Secretary of War. For most of America's early history, we didn't have a Department of Defense. We had a Department of War. After World War II, in the anxious first years of the Cold War, Washington reorganized the military and rebranded the whole enterprise. Today, that name, Defense, is in the news again, with a push from the White House to bring back Department of War. What did war mean then? Why did we switch to defense? And what would it mean to switch back now? As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you desire, as we dig right into the history of the Department of War, from its origins in the Constitution and some of the early challenges it faced, to its rebranding following the Second World War and the rise of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. Article 2, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution mentions the executive departments and places the president in charge of them as the leader of the executive branch, but it does not specifically spell out what those departments are. When Washington was inaugurated as the nation's first president, the executive branch only had four cabinet positions that were created by an act of Congress. They were the Secretary of State, the Secretary of War, the Secretary of Treasury, and the Attorney General. To lead the War Department, Washington chose Henry Knox, a trusted general from the Revolutionary War, whose expertise in logistics made him an invaluable member of the Continental Army. As the War Secretary, Knox oversaw frontier policy, militia organization, fort construction, and diplomacy with Native nations during the Northwest Indian War, which ended with the Treaty of Greenville in 1795. In 1794, Knox also supported Washington's decision to mobilize the militia against the Whiskey Rebellion, a key early test of federal authority. After Knox retired at the end of the 1794, Timothy Pickering briefly served, followed by James McHenry, who bridged the Washington and John Adams administrations. Under Adams, the War Department navigated the quasi-war with France, an undeclared naval conflict that spurred naval expansion and coastal defenses, even as Adams ultimately pushed for peace. With Thomas Jefferson, the title stays war, but the focus shifts. Henry Dearborn is Secretary of War through the First Barbary War, America's first sustained overseas conflict fought to protect U.S. shipping from North African corsairs. The war ended with an agreement that the United States would continue to pay tribute to the Muslim states in North Africa in exchange for promises of safe passage for American shipping. Following Jefferson's administration, James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, learned a harsh lesson on the costs of disorganization and incompetence as the War Department, under the leadership of Secretary William Eustis and later John Armstrong, Jr., presided over an army ill-prepared to fight the War of 1812 against the British. After British troops under the command of Major General Robert Ross successfully marched on Washington, D.C. and burned the city, President Madison turned to James Monroe to bring stability to the department. The War of 1812 also saw a resurgence of attacks on American shipping by Muslim pirates and action encouraged by the British. After the end of the war, Madison sent the fleet to resume conflict with the Barbary pirates, which ended with the submission of the North African states and an end to the practice of paying tribute altogether. In the early years of the Republic, the War Secretary was responsible for managing land forces, frontier conflicts, occasional overseas fights, and the complicated blend of diplomacy and coercion. It did not resemble the centralized, multi-service, gargantuan department that we know today. The major reorganization that created the modern Defense Department did not come until after World War II and the onset of the Cold War. In December 1945, just 3 months after the official signing ceremony in Tokyo Bay that officially ended the war, President Harry Truman urged Congress to reorganize the entire apparatus that was responsible for the defense of the country. He stated, "I recommend that the reorganization of the armed forces be along the following lines. There should be a single Department of National Defense. This department should be charged with the full responsibility for armed national security. It should consist of the armed and civilian forces that are now included within the War and Navy departments." It is an interesting fact that, at the time, the Department of the Navy was not a part of the War Department. 19 months later, Truman got his wish when the Congress passed the National Security Act of 1947. As a result, there occurred a drastic reorganization of the military. The separate branches of the Army, Navy, and the newly created Air Force now fell under the same national military establishment. The Act also established the Marine Corps as an independent service within the Navy. But the Act didn't simply reorganize the armed forces. It also established the National Security Council and the Central Intelligence Agency. 2 years later, the Act was amended, and the current Department of Defense was created. The amendments converted the National Military Establishment in the cabinet-level Defense Department. The three military branches were placed under the authority of the Secretary of Defense. The military chief of staff to the Commander-in-Chief was replaced with the full-time chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Finally, the War Council was renamed the Armed Forces Policy Council. Behind the scenes, the path wasn't smooth. The first Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, wary of over-centralization, pushed coordination over command. His successor, Louis Johnson, used the 1949 changes to tighten civilian control and budget discipline. Historians in the Pentagon's own historical office note that the 1949 amendments were designed to make unification actually work. Another key driver was early Cold War strategy. The State Department's history site is blunt. These reforms created the institutions presidents needed to manage crises and deter war in the nuclear age. And in scholarship, you often see the line that this was the law that transformed America, reshaping how the U.S. wages peace and war. Finally, the name defense wasn't cosmetic. It advertised a strategic posture, deterrence, integration, and civilian control in a world where preventing war was as important as winning one. The renaming of the War Council to the Armed Forces Policy Council had another purpose, just as the use of the word defense. At the beginning of the Cold War, the United States was in a propaganda war with the Soviet Union. The U.S. worked hard to create a narrative that the nation's goal was peace, and that the department in control of the armed forces understood that the use of military force was a necessary reaction to communist aggression. While the U.S. has failed to live up to the narrative it created much of the time, especially in Latin America, words have meanings, and in the world of international diplomacy, those meanings matter. Which brings us to where we find ourselves today. The White House is moving to rebrand the Pentagon as the Department of War by executive order, using Department of War as a secondary official title while seeking full congressional approval for a permanent change. The stated aim, project a stronger warrior ethos. According to Reuters, the order would authorize Department of War usage in official communications and instruct the secretary to propose steps to make the change permanent. Supporters say the old name reflects reality. Critics call it costly symbolism at odds with post-1949 norms and warn it could send an aggressive signal abroad. The first hurdle Trump will have to get over, just like every other executive order he has produced to affect governmental change, will be the inevitable court fight. Anyone who has been following this administration, even sporadically, understands that before the ink is dry on his signature on the executive order, Opposition groups are already in the process of filing a lawsuit in federal court to reverse his order. Executive orders designed to steer policy changes in the federal bureaucracy that falls under the authority of the executive branch do not carry the same weight as legislation. The presidency is not a monarchy, and Trump is finding it difficult, if not impossible, to rule by decree. However, in this case, congressional action may be required. The Department of Defense, like all cabinet agencies, was created by an act of Congress. It is hard to imagine that the courts would rule that Trump would have the authority to, in effect, make the kind of changes that have always required legislation. In this case, Trump's EO simply gets the label into circulation and forces lawmakers to take up the issue. Then there are costs involved. Democrat Senator Tammy Duckworth, herself a disabled military veteran, asked the question, why not put this money towards supporting military families, or toward employing diplomats that help prevent conflicts from starting in the first place? Looking at the issue from a diplomat's point of view, it reeks of a sophomoric attempt at dick measuring, an exercise in unnecessary bravado that can only serve to make the work of the State Department more difficult as Trump cedes the moral high ground to adversaries like China or Russia, nations thrilled to portray the U.S. as a dangerous loose cannon on the international stage. After all, Chinese leader Xi will no doubt argue that their massive military buildup and attempts to create military partnerships all over the world have nothing to do with any expansionist goals, but instead have everything to do with protecting themselves and others from the warmongering United States. The point is, what's the point? Diplomacy is an art, and just another tool used as part of a greater strategy designed to gain and maintain power over your adversaries. The best example of someone who understood that was probably Sun Tzu, but if expert diplomacy is akin to Rembrandt creating a masterpiece painting, the circus in the White House paints like a drunk chimpanzee with deteriorating motor function. But the problem here is that this goes much deeper than the juvenile attempt at bravado. The true problem is the attitude that comes with it. Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, and Pete Hegseth act as if they are putting the world on notice that the U.S. is now going to be the aggressor and bully our way through world affairs because we have a powerful military and we are just itching to unleash it. That may play well with MAGA supporters, but it is a troublesome development as far as the rest of the world is concerned. Regarding effective foreign policy, Theodore Roosevelt famously stated, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." This administration's motto is, "Demand loudly and threaten everyone everywhere." Hopefully, Congress will refuse to cooperate with this latest rebranding. The decision to eliminate the Department of War and replace it with the better organized Department of Defense was the right move in 1949. It is still the right move. Renaming the department to try to look more intimidating is not solving problems. It's just virtue signaling. Trump and his supporters are so fond of pointing out woke virtue signaling when they see it, but here they cheer it on instead. As I said before, the name defense wasn't cosmetic. It advertised a strategic posture in a world where preventing war was as important as winning one. Finally, consider this. We live in a world where perception often becomes reality. That concludes this week's episode. If you find this podcast informative or entertaining, please like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. The same goes if you tune in on YouTube. Also, if you have anything you would like to add to the conversation, or if there is a topic you would like to see covered on this show, please leave a comment. Until next time, remember this: get informed and fight to keep your political representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.